Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Michael Tolkin, the author of the new book from the Atlantic Monthly Press, NK3. So right away, basics, what does NK3 stand for?
North Korea 3. It's the third iteration of a weaponized nanobacterium that the North Korean military tested on the South Korean military at the DMZ, the Demilitarized Zone. And through a mistake, as these things go, the drug was designed to confuse the memories of the North Korean officer class guarding the border, and instead has spread like wildfire around the world, and the world has lost its memory.
The world has lost its memory. Memory is loss, is accompanied by feelings of extreme pleasure.
Initially. Right.
Exactly. And because it spreads to Los Angeles, where most of NK3 takes place, it's significant that one of its first victims is the daughter of a studio head.
The daughter of the head of Warner Brothers.
Her name is Erin, and I found the description of her attack very powerful. I'm going to ask you to read it so that people know the intensity of the writing of this book. Michael Tolkin reading from around the second chapter of NK3.
Erin was 19 by the old calendar, but by the only calendar that mattered, she was 4. In the known world, by the new calendar, 4 was ancient. The new calendar 4-year-olds had been rehabilitated 4 years ago by the best doctors in the city. They had been given the kind of attention and thorough cortical stimulation, 3 weeks in a controlled coma, that was no longer possible since the best doctors themselves were gone and the replacements they had trained didn't understand the subtleties of the machines and drugs, or were forced to abbreviate the cure because the drugs had run out. The scale of the disaster obliged them to focus on the minimal rehab needed for the Systems Committee, that's capital S, capital C, to continue without falling apart. Systems, the largest committee, meant Toby Tyler and her crew, the master civil engineers. They were granted the privilege of rehab even before medical specialists. There was no medical committee. Plus, and this isn't a small thing, no one can run a smashed rehab machine. The daughter of privilege, born lucky, Erin's good fortune continued even when she was one of the first 300 people in Los Angeles to be diagnosed with what was then called Sol Syndrome Release 3.0. The first puzzling and awful symptom hit her 32 hours after a long night at a karaoke bar in Koreatown. There she was, walking in a corridor at her high school, when she felt the unfamiliar awakening of her soul's recognition of God's love. And with that, galaxies of old resentments rolled out of her, memories of insults and bad grades and rejection and envy, like a movie reel unspooling into a fire. And in the empty space left by all that crap, she fell into an infinity of peace. She tried to explain this feeling to everyone around her in the school corridor, where no one ever talked about the love of God. In the school nurse's office, the first assumption was that she was high on ecstasy. But then she kept saying goodbye to memories as she watched them take to the air like a flock of swallows leaving a disappearing barn and disappearing into a disappearing sky. She failed the basic mental status exam, time, place, count backward, who's the president. The evil of the syndrome was that the victims felt relief as NK3 swept through their brains before wiping them out. When the area's emergency rooms compared notes after the first 100 cases, the Centers for Disease Control broadcast the description of the disease, which matched the epidemic marching through Asia. When Aaron's father, the president of Warner Brothers, understood what had invaded his baby girl, he called UCLA Hospital's chief of surgery and asked for the kind of favor typically and not covertly granted the charitable president of a studio, to put Aaron at the head of the line for the first available bed in the SRC, the Syndrome Rehabilitation Center.
Now, what happens is that these characters not only lose their memory, they lose their knowledge. They don't know their own names in many cases. And the definition of words changes like 180 degrees. So in this new culture, post-NK3, rehab doesn't refer to substance abuse. Rehab refers to the degree to which a sufferer, nearly everyone, has been able to be resituated in a culture that no longer knows how to use its machines, that doesn't have access to its computers, because if they remember how to work them, they've lost the codes.
Right, the passwords are gone.
So this is a novel that has to be written in a situation past communication. The writing itself becomes a struggle for the characters to articulate what they no longer have access to. Was that murder to write?
It took me 7 years. I took it apart two or three times when I had 50, 70,000 words, and I started over, and I've never done that before. About a third of the way through on my previous four novels, I knew the final paragraph, so I knew where I was going. And this one was a beat-up wind all the way.
Yeah. As the city breaks down, its cultural codes break down too. So as the possibility of treatment becomes unlikely, the city's elite are the people who've undergone sufficient rehab to still function. They're kept separate. The people, the drifters,
shamblerettes, shamblerinas, drifters, driftettes,
they're around Figueroa.
Right.
They're street people.
Right. The reverse in society is that the aristocracy that ran the city when NK3 hits know that they need the people who know how to actually run things to get in the head of the line, so that people who have motor memory skills, people who are plumbers, people who are electricians, people who know how to run the hard systems of the city are granted NK3 first. Once they've got it, by the time the aristocracy, the political and intellectual leaders of the city expected to be rehabbed, it's too late. The machinery is deliberately destroyed so that the new aristocracy is composed of the people who actually have a physical memory. It's like a surgeon. Surgeons are potentially rehabbed because they do their hands remember so much physical training.
So the new aristocracy tends to be the former working class.
Tends to be the former working class
with muscle memory.
Right.
And even they are working at a disability.
Right.
They're working with limited, failing memory.
Yes.
Now, Michael.
Yes, sir.
Given that I feel every morning when I wake up, I'm waking up into the apocalypse, or at least into the pre-apocalypse, do you think this is an unusual sensibility, or do you feel that too?
No, I think probably since the Civil War and mechanized slaughter to that scale, that we've been moving into this dismal future. And I think right now, you know, with the election, we've crossed the threshold.
Into what?
Well, there's going to be some mass culling of the herd, which is what the book is about in part. It's about mass death. There's very few people left. And one thing we have to note is that the aristocracy of the city has constructed a 60-foot-tall wall around the perimeters of, well, it's from West Hollywood to Westwood, from to the Ventura Boulevard to roughly Olympic Boulevard, and they've created a compound inside, which is, and this is something no one has pointed this out yet, because not enough people who go to Burning Man have recognized the book. But in some way, the key to the book is to understand Burning Man, because they've created a Burning Man civilization within Los Angeles.
I'm talking to Michael Tolkien about his new novel, NK3, that has the startling insight that even after the apocalypse, after the end, there will still be the rapid formation of hierarchy. Hierarchy,
yes.
And who is in charge,
right.
And who knows what of the limited things to know, become central to the aspirations of the book's characters.
Right, yes, because the hive mind is not eradicated. In fact, the leadership structure is more important in this in everybody's daily lives than it is in our daily life. One of the things that's happening in the book is that to keep the city from being habitable outside of the fence, they're burning the city. They're burning Los Angeles in sections. And the book, the burn area in the book, as that's the subject of the book, is roughly south central LA to Culver City, south to the Baldwin Hills and Culver City.
And we go there with the characters, and by accident, a woman with an unusual amount of memory, or rather her skills come from having been a curator,
right,
of furniture at a museum. So she knows the difference between imitation Eames and real Eames.
Right. She's miserable. Her real name is Sonia Price. But before she found out her real name was Sonia Price, she took the name Susie Banshee. And she's a curator, a fine arts curator from New York, who was brought out at the beginning of NK3 to help catalog the holdings of the LA County Museum. And she had been what she thought she was going to be, which is verified. If you've been given a through this the verification process, it means you have been given a rehab and you have marketable skills, necessary skills, and you're allowed to live inside the world of the fence.
This is performed by the DMV, which stands for
Department of Mandatory Verification. There are crews that are sent out throughout Southern California looking for people, and they bring them to the DMV. They take their photograph. The photograph is matched into the computer. And if they turn out to have had skills, the kind of necessary skills, they are introduced into the community. But there's a flaw in the computer, and it doesn't have all the alphabet. So a lot of people who would be verified can't be verified. And poor Susie Banshee is one of them.
And a lot of people not only have taken new names, but have lost their original ones. So one character who's looking for his wife, but doesn't know her name.
Right.
And looking for his daughter. And he finds her skeleton.
Right.
And a gown that she was wearing.
A pink, puffy pink gown that she was wearing.
And inside the label says Disney.
Right.
And he assumes
that's her name, Disney. There's another character who is given a name. The label says Made in USA, and so she becomes Marianusa.
And now, you've written this book as a kind of thriller, but I see it as a nightmare.
Well, I mean, nightmare. Yeah, I hope it's a nightmare. I think it's constructed much more like a nightmare than it is a standard thriller. Although there are certain things. You know, there are searches. There are a number of people searching for answers, searching for other people. People are expecting other people. But the central search, the character Hopper is looking for his wife. He doesn't know his name, doesn't know what she looks like. She, we find, waiting for him. She doesn't know who he is, doesn't know his name, and doesn't know what he looks like. So there's just this possibility, this little bit of memory that's left, but the impulse is greater than the intellect.
And, well, put it this way. These are people who, in certain cases, have had memory implants. Others have spoken to them so persuasively that they've taken other people's memories as their own. They're living under the directive of other and sometimes vanished, unavailable minds.
Right. You mean the silent voices?
Yeah.
Right. So there's people in the way that, say, if you and I talk to ourselves, we know that we are talking to ourselves. If we hear a voice saying, well, anything internal, we know that that's our voice. They don't know that. So they have a relationship with, and I don't want to call it the subconscious, but they have a relationship with their thoughts that are completely alienated.
What happens to compassion? Is that a function of memory?
Well, let's see. There's a character named Marcy who goes to work at the motor pool, and one of the men at the motor pool falls in love with her, and the other two men, the three guys working at the motor pool, and the boss likes her because she's very good at cleaning up. She's actually a spy. She's infiltrated the motor pool for story reasons. He wants to give her a name, and they want to call her Hey You or even insulting names, and he thinks the name he'd really like to give her would be Valvoline. Valvoline is very pretty. He thinks it would be a good name for her, but then he decides, for reasons, he chooses another name. And that's compassionate. That's his compassion. Giving her a name, a pretty name, would be an act of deep compassion.
She is disguised as a shamblerina.
Yes.
These are people largely without skills. They dance naked at the center of bottle tapping
right.
circles of men who appreciate them. That's another Burning Man situation.
The shamblerinas are people who have been living at the fringes of society, scrounging for food in the homes that have been emptied of that are empty because the previous inhabitants are the dead. There's the society itself is subsisting on some food from the Central Valley that they trade for, but mostly from the food remaining in the big supermarkets and the box stores and the warehouses. And the shamblerinas have no real language, no skills. They're not trained. They've never been through any kind of rehab. And this is true for, there's drifters, driftettes, shamblers, and shamblerinas. And the nightly on Figueroa, which is the boulevard of dreams for the people who don't live inside the compound, nightly. These creeps, I thought the bottle bangers were very creepy, who get the shamblerinas to dance, and they can't dance. They have no sense of rhythm anymore. That's been lost. So they strip them, they dance naked, they knock them around, and our central figures rescues one of them from the bottle bangers.
Yes.
The bottle bangers take empty vodka bottles and with a metal spoon and just a bang. Well, I don't have a bottle with me, but they bang away.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Michael Tolkien about his book, NK3. We'll be back after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Michael Tolkien about his book, NK3. a dire tale that examines the role memory plays in thriving versus merely surviving in the post-apocalyptic Los Angeles of the near future. And it's said that the founders, those people who are no longer here, who are in the sky, have left behind an endless profusion of nurture, of food,
yes,
for the homeless.
Right.
And, well, whether this is in fact so, it's mythologically so. And one of the committees is a committee of one.
The committee, June Moulton, the head, the only member of the mythology committee.
Yes. The only member of the mythology committee who, in a certain way, inherits. Because the question is, of course, now, after all this bottle banging, do they have music? And the answer is yes. They have a music goddess.
Right. If this event had happened and Lady Gaga had disappeared or Madonna had disappeared and then had been found out in the boonies, ignorant of who she had been, except that she's got a tattoo on her back. She has the most famous tattoo in the world, and the tattoo artist was a tattooist in Moscow. So when that tattoo is seen by Aaron, who reveres the character Shannon Squires, reveres her music, she is brought into the community.
The tattoo has been on the back of her album cover. It's something that is part of visual memory.
Right, right. It was enough of an icon so that it was also the poster. It was also the album cover.
Yes. Shannon doesn't know at this point her own songs.
No.
She has to be taught them. Her autobiography,
yes,
is one of Aaron's treasured,
yes,
possessions.
Right, also because Aaron's father was the head of Warner Brothers, Aaron had been to many concerts, and Aaron has framed tickets from concerts all around the world, but doesn't remember having gone to them, and doesn't know whether these were gifts as souvenirs somebody else had collected, or whether she had actually participated in.
So do they have music? They have Shannon, and Shannon is, in her way, someone with an intuitive, deeply intuitive sense of what her sound. It doesn't have to be a song. It, in this book, it's a long, prolonged vowel sound.
Right.
And it organizes people to a sense of global community.
She triggers a psychic connection with everybody in the community, everybody who sits around her while she's singing to them from the head of a 6-story tall effigy of a woman dancing that stands next to a 6-story tall effigy of a man called the man. So one is called he's called the man and she's called the woman, and again, burners know the reference. And when she triggers people's memories, it's not so simple as triggering a memory of your birthday party. People's memories are so wrapped up with popular entertainment or with movies and television that nobody can separate their own memory and their own experience from the experience of the television shows they used to watch or the movies they used to watch when they were whole.
It's kind of like the amazing role music plays for people with Alzheimer's. And in fact, Michael...
Yes, I hadn't thought about that. Yes.
While I was reading this book, it was inevitable for me that I was thinking a great deal of my mother, who, while not diagnosed with Alzheimer's, is diagnosed with dementia. And she doesn't really know for sure. She certainly doesn't remember my father. She sometimes remembers me, but sometimes asks me, "Michael, I'm so sorry I haven't asked. How are your parents?" And I have to say, "Mom, you're my mother, and my father is dead. and I name them and I tell her about them. But in a certain way, this novel has a realism, a biological realism about it. We're in a culture that has grown forgetful with age. It's more and more common, it seems to me. Is it just that I'm getting older and I know older people? Or was it always the case? Because I remember my grandmother, Russian, who lived to be 101, lived with us. She remembered so much.
It's interesting, because my father had died 8 years ago, and just 93 and with dementia, too. That, although I hadn't really thought about it this way, that definitely informed my ideas about memory in the book.
It's kind of fascinating because you're in a half-waking state in reading this novel. The thrill of reading a thriller that's not about answers, but about a progression of events that becomes more and more serious.
Right.
As you go along and as you understand it better and better. You'll want to start reading the book again when you finish it, because by the time it's over, the great buzzing confusion of the beginning has all resolved. And now what's left is the residue of terror.
Yeah, it's always so great. Michael, it's always so great talking to you because you force me to think about my book in a way that I haven't even when I was writing it, and I think that what you see are a lot of the deep structural associations that are there when you're writing a book that are really subconscious, because you can't be in charge of every meaning.
I've been talking with Michael Tolkien, author of NK3, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from NK3 at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Rev. David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Steve Erickson is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.